What's up, everybody? Welcome to the DDHD podcast, where a dream is what you make it, but you never make it without a dream. And once again, we have a very special guest in the house, a good friend of mine, creative entrepreneur, mentor at the Remix Project, amazing graphic designer, and is in the street photography space right now. Welcome, everybody, to my homie, Brian Brock. Is in the house.
Yo. Thank you, man.
Thank you for coming, bro.
Yo, I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, it's been a minute.
For sure.
You know me and you go way back.
Too far.
Too far.
Yeah, we're going to date ourselves.
I'm not going to do that. But I do want to start at the beginning a little bit, because I feel like, you know, our childhood is usually what shapes us. It's the foundation of our success sometimes, most of the time, actually. So I just want to know, like, yo, what was it like growing up for you, and where you at now?
Yeah. Okay. So growing up, I feel like maybe a lot of us out there were attracted to like one thing that kind of shaped or molded us.
Yeah.
For me, that was music.
Yeah.
I definitely didn't come up as a rapper.
You got bars though.
Yeah, I got a few bars. But I was into the culture as a whole. Yes. So I started really early as like a b-boy, a DJ. I'm a visual artist, so of course graffiti came like super natural to me. Just like the culture as a whole, hip-hop, that like I feel raised a bunch of us in a generation. So that was like the inspiration behind me even trying things and doing stuff. And then when I realized I could couple like that God-given talent of visual arts, like I could just draw, I could couple that with the things that I loved in like music, culture, art, all of a sudden I was like, yo, there's like a crossroads here. And I didn't ever know, or maybe I didn't see something that existed before me that said this was doable. And that's when I just started doing things collaboratively with my own skill sets. Hmm. So from DJing, I would make mixtapes, but the mixtapes, I would get to design the album artwork or like the mixtape cover. For DJing and event producing eventually and promoting, I would do that, but I would also throw the party, design the flyers, do the tickets. And then from like the dance world, you're just like in a whole different version of self-expression. So I think when I was younger, I was just doing all these things because I enjoyed it. I loved it. I didn't necessarily have a goal, but, they were all just ways to express yourself as a teenager.
100%, man. And, so you born and raised in Toronto?
Nah.
No.
A lot of people don't know that. I actually moved here when I was 19.
What?
Yeah. I went to, I grew up in London, Ontario.
Right.
And then I went to Humber College in, I think, 2020. No, sorry, 2000.
Right.
That's when I moved to Toronto. And yeah, man, I haven't looked back since.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy, man. So, and what was your experience in Toronto when you first got here? Was it?
Yo, it was crazy overwhelming.
Yeah.
So like Toronto's a spot I would come to every summer as a kid growing up, going to like Blue Jays games, going shopping, looking for music, like digging in the crates at Play D on Yonge. So I was exposed to Toronto, but as a visitor, like as a guest. Most of the artists that I looked up to from that era were all from Toronto, like Canadian wise, you know, Cardi, Choclair, Sox, Julie Black, like, everyone in, well, The Circle, you know, the list goes on and on. Ghetto Concept, everyone was from Toronto. So I had like an idea, but I didn't grow up here the same way. So I wasn't in the streets. I also wasn't in the same high school basketball teams. I wasn't in even some of the same like party light.
Right.
So my connection to the city was as a visitor.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I moved here, I feel like very fortunate. Mutual friend, Sean Booth.
My guy,
you know, aka Ricochet, aka you name it.
Yeah.
He actually was originally from Toronto and moved to London when he was younger, and he still had the connection with Low.
Right.
And Low was connected with Tyson and T-Rex and, you know, all of Oakwood.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like when I got introduced to those guys, which are like my brothers now, they opened the door to Toronto for me that I probably couldn't have opened for myself.
I love that, man.
Yeah.
Let's go even further back, like, because I like to talk about the village, right? And how that can sometimes shape us as well. How you grew up, this, your support system, if you had one, or even if you didn't have one, how that can shape who you are today. So did you have a support system growing up? Like, were you encouraged to follow these dreams, or did you just find them on your own?
This was the era when, like, if you were into rap,
yes,
you were like the outcast. Mm. And in my world, so growing up in London, this was like in the early 90s. It would be like high school for me.
Yeah.
Everyone was not into like rap music. Right. I was like an outsider. And then when it comes to like being an artist, like a visual artist, you're already like the nerd in art class, right? Like, you're not necessarily looked at as cool, or like, you're not the one people want to hang out with. Like, you're the guy in the corner, like, doing your thing. So I think for me, I always felt alone as myself. But the interesting thing was, I'm very confident and comfortable in my own skin from an early age. And that goes all the way back, like, super personal issue, but I'm actually adopted. And my parents told me that when I was like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years old, like, as soon as you could kind of
comprehend. That's pretty early, yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah. There's like a children's book that you can like read, and it kind of teaches you what it's all about.
Yeah.
I love that book. It like literally changed my life.
Wow.
So that instance kind of forced me to ask myself difficult questions as I was growing up.
Do you remember the name of the book?
I googled it before, because I actually want to like repurchase that
for sure.
But I think me finding that out at a young age allowed me to start to discover who I might be, mm-hmm. and ask some hard questions, mm-hmm. and lean into things that really interested me. Right. So my support system, I had a loving family, but my family didn't understand hip hop culture, definitely didn't understand being an artist as a career, didn't understand promoting or marketing or DJing. Like, those things didn't exist when my parents were kids, right? So to no fault of their own, they just didn't get it. So my support system was little to none, but I was okay with that. It gave you like some motivation, can I do this? Or let me prove other people wrong. And that kind of ties back into like when you're young, you're like, especially as a young male, you got anger issues for one reason or another. You got to have an outlet. And I felt like my outlet was being creative. So that was my journey in high school. My support system was little to none. Mm. And then the interesting thing, as I got into Toronto, that's when I actually started to understand what community was. Mm. I didn't actually have a community when I was a kid.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, man. I mean, that's even stronger, because it takes a very strong will person to not have that so-called support system.
Yeah.
Like, even for myself, and I feel like a lot of people who grew up in a Caribbean household who wanted to do something outside of what their parents wanted you to
for
do,
sure.
it's a fight. Right.
Yeah.
I can remember earliest memories of me starting to get into music, and my dad being so against it. Like, you know, you need to go to college. You need to do this. You need to get a good job. That support, and through no fault of their own, because that's what they know.
Yeah.
Right. That's why they came to this country, so we could have those opportunities. And to go against that, you know, it's kind of disappointing for them.
Yeah.
But as we learn, as we get older, you can't control what your kids want to do. You can just guide them and stuff.
Yep.
So I fully agree with that. So what is, can you tell me some of the earliest memories of you falling in love with what you do right now? Do you have a memory that you can maybe?
That's a great question. Okay, so when I was younger, I had a dream of like doing album artwork for artists.
Yeah.
And before I moved to Toronto, I didn't have access to any artists other than like local people. And the interesting thing is, I'm still friends with these people today, Sean Booth being one of them, but Matisse.
Yes.
He was originally from London as well.
Right.
And I actually shot and designed his first EP.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when like cassettes were the thing.
Oh,
like,
damn.
Actually physically selling cassette tapes.
Wow.
Yeah. And
yeah, you just dated yourself, bro.
I know. It's all right.
It's okay.
I'm like slowly growing into this OG status.
Me
I'm
too.
I'm okay with it.
Me too, yeah.
But yeah, man, that was probably the first memory I had of designing something and shooting something that I'd always wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the blueprint that led me into what I got to do later in life as a graphic designer and photographer and creative in the Toronto space.
Mm-hmm. You brought up Sean Booth and Ricochet, AKA, and you know, good friend of mine. I saw him recently over the summer, and we were reminiscing about the one-by-one days and
crazy.
Our foundation days and how we used to always get, everybody thought I was Ricochet, and everybody used to think he was Rochester for a long time.
100%.
Yeah. So can you speak a little bit about the one-by-one days and what was that like?
I feel like that was our training ground.
Yeah.
Like, not just for us as our crew, but like in Toronto at that time, you know, it was notoriously the Screwface capital.
Yep.
And I feel like our era was the first generation to start to break that like stereotype down, or that title.
Mm-hmm.
We were the first group of people that were willing to work with other
yes.
people from different neighborhoods, different crews, different whatever.
Yeah.
And maybe people did that before, but it wasn't celebrated.
Right.
I think we were the first to be able to like welcome it. And things like the barbershop show.
Yes.
Like, we had Hustle Man. We had you. Mm-hmm. We had surprise performers from Sox. We had all these different people from different walks of life in one space.
Yeah.
And I think for me, that was my training ground as a designer anyways, because I was doing all the designs for the barbershop show flyers and the Sean Booth art, album artwork.
Yeah.
And then eventually transitioning into doing bigger projects, getting to work on Cardinal's album, the record he did with Akon.
Yes.
That
not
was
for
like,
sale, the Not For Sale album?
Yeah, the Not For Sale
That's
album.
Such a classic cover, man. I just wanted to make sure I bigged you up on that. Everybody knows it. Cardi with the army helmet on.
Yeah.
And the barcode across his mouth, man. It just, I remember seeing that CD and it was just like, whoa.
It's crazy, right?
Such a good job.
I can't take full credit for that cover because the photographer at the time actually shot and edited that barcode.
Mm-hmm.
I just did the design work.
Right.
But that was my first big graphic design project for a major artist on a major label.
Right.
Yeah. And I think from the one-by-one days to working with major artists, it was all just like stepping stones to prepare me to be able to say, yes, I can do this.
Yeah.
Because you think you can do it, but you don't know.
What was it going to work with a major label? Was that a difficult thing for you, like working with a bigger brand and like having to take notes and stuff like that?
It was definitely a different process.
Right.
I still remember, I think he might have been with Universal at the time. I can't fully remember, but they gave me a stack of photos on printouts that was literally like this big. And I had to go through like 500 pages of photos and select what I wanted to use for the album inserts and the foldouts and the credits and all that. So that process right away was like totally different than anything I've ever done. And then the budget, I actually had a budget. Like, I actually had money to pay me to do the work, or at least enough money that made sense. Whereas like when we're doing it for each other, like we're paying each other out of our own pocket, or we have no money, so it's off the strength. So that was a big like eye-opening experience for me. And then I think just Cardi had a lot of hands-on on that one, so there wasn't a lot of back and forth from the album.
Right.
But as I got into the music space even more and working with groups like Division, you have way more like hands in the pot, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, you start to understand like how much of it is your vision and your skill set and what you bring to the table versus like making sure you're delivering on what the artist wants, what the label wants, what the manager wants. And it's a super cool experience to go through, but I think I wouldn't have gotten there if I didn't do that stuff in the early days where I was just trying to figure it out on my own or with my boys.
You I have the utmost amount of respect for entrepreneurs, and so, you know, I have respect for the new ones now, and now that it's a cool word to say.
Yeah.
But there was a time when it was almost like a four-letter word to be an entrepreneur, right?
Totally.
But you've been in this space for a while, and I think our community are probably, a lot of them are trying to make that transition. They might have full-time jobs or part-time jobs, and they're really passionate about what their side hustle is and wanting to turn that into their main hustle.
Yeah.
As somebody who's been an entrepreneur for
Long ass time.
Long ass time. where did that transition happen for you? Like, have you worked day jobs before?
Yeah. Okay, that's an amazing question. So after Humber College,
yeah,
I had no idea what was going to happen. I did freelance design work on the side, but I thought I wanted to be in the advertising industry. So I had a internship at an ad agency, and that was like a cool experience, but it wasn't really what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
So I kind of exited that, and then I had a surprise actually kind of happen where I got offered another internship like not too long after. This was back in Flow 93 5 days. So I got offered an internship at Flow, and I actually turned it down.
Because really?
Yeah, because back then it was okay to do unpaid internships. Right. And I was living, like, I had bills. I was on my own, so I had bills to pay. I couldn't do another unpaid internship back to back. So I said no, and I'm really thankful. I feel like this is my, like, unsung hero or mentor, but Aisha Wickham.
Yes.
She reached back out and said, you know what? Like, we'd really love to have you in the space. Like, what could we work out? And I remember I had a part-time job doing design work for like 3 days a week. So I was able to do that, pay my bills. And Flo was able to give me two days a week as an intern, unpaid. And then the craziest thing happened over the course of that internship, which I probably did for like 6 months.
Yeah.
I got pulled into the boardroom one day by Nicole Jolly. Mm-hmm. She was the VP at the time. And she was just like, yo, on a scale of 1 to 10, like, how confident are you if we needed you to step into the graphic designer role? And I was like mind blown that this is even a conversation. And I totally lied. I said I was a 7, and I said I could get to a 10 in like a month if I had the opportunity.
Right.
I was like a 3.
You got to do those though, you know? Man. Yeah.
I was like a 3 in all honesty. Mm-hmm. But that was like my first big moment. I would call it my big break. I haven't had many big breaks in my life, but I feel like that was one of the early ones. And I went back the next day and I said yes, and they slid a contract across the boardroom table. I signed that shit and I had my first full-time job.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this is Flow?
This is Flow, the mecca of hip-hop, the center of the universe for us.
Yeah.
Other than college radio, which like was a probably the blueprint for most of us.
Absolutely.
But I mean, Flow was the first commercial radio station that played mm-hmm. hip hop, R&B, reggae, soca, like you name it.
Yeah.
And I was this kid from London, Ontario that grew up in loving the culture, being a part of the culture, but now I'm like part of the Institute. So that was an unprecedented time for me. I felt so fortunate.
Yeah.
And very thankful to Aisha yeah. to push me to take that internship. And that full-time job led me to other full-time jobs as right. I graduated from Flow and went on to other spaces.
Right.
And the whole time I had a full-time job,
right.
I still was doing freelance graphic design on the side, and I was still throwing events. DJing had kind of slowed down, but I had turned that into like actually producing and promoting the events.
Dope.
So I always had that going at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's when I started to learn about like multiple streams of income.
Right.
But eventually I got myself into a position where I had a design job at a studio.
Okay.
And I thought it was cool. I'm at a computer. I'm doing a different project every day. This is what I thought I signed up for. And then I was like, my soul was dying. Like, I can't explain the feeling other than that my body was telling me I'm not meant to be here. And that's when I knew like having a job is not for me.
Yeah.
I've been an entrepreneur since high school, but it was like for fun and side hustles. You didn't know what was possible. And when I had that design job, they literally, similar boardroom scenario.
Right.
They literally brought me in for my annual review and they were like, hey, you've exceeded us on this level, you've gotten better at this. We'd like to give you a raise. And the raise was probably like $2,000 or $3,000.
Right.
Which back then like sounds like a lot. But when you break that down over 26 pay periods, $2,000 or $3,000 is like maybe 100 extra bucks, maybe $70 after tax on your paycheck. You're like, why is it worth it? Is this what I want? And I already had that feeling of not wanting to be in that role. So honestly, I went back the next day and was like, I quit.
The next day?
The next day, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but I will say I went home that night and I made a list. And I was like, if I'm going to quit, what's my worst case scenario, my middle ground, and my best case?
Yeah.
And this is maybe something that like other folks out there that are doing the 9-to-5 grind but have the side hustle, maybe they could take away. But I went home and I was like, if I quit, what can I do on my worst case scenario? So I checked with my graphic design and I checked with my events and I was like, worst case, I can pay my bills,
yes,
but I can't do anything else. So there'd be no like parties, no drinking, no vacation, no new clothes, nothing. Right. Just pay the bills and I would survive. My middle ground was like, oh, maybe I can make a little bit more money and like give this thing a try.
Mm-hmm.
And my best case was maybe I can surpass what I was doing at my job. And at that time, my job was paying me like 45 grand a year. They wanted to give me that raise of like 2 or 3 grand. So I would have been up to like 47, 48, which was a lot of money for me back then. And today still is a lot of money.
Hell yeah.
So it was a tough decision to say, no, I'm going to walk away. But when you feel it in your gut, and most creative people or entrepreneurs, they have a voice inside of them. Well, we all have that voice inside of ourselves, but the difference is creative people and entrepreneurs decide to listen to the voice. And I listened to the voice, I quit. And that was probably my biggest year to date. I mean, I ended up using that 40 to 50 hours a week that I was spending at the desk job, pouring that energy into myself every week. And I ended up making like double what I made at my salary job that year.
Wow.
Just by saying, like, you know?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So, yeah, I would say I found out early enough that it didn't suck the life out of me.
Wow. Yo, that is, you said so many powerful things in that statement. One thing that resonated with me was like how you kind of planned it out. Like you looked at the wage that you would have. You looked at, I guess, your happiness scale of what that would be, and then how you could maneuver that, and was it really worth it? And I say that to a lot of people who ask me about that transition. I'm actually new to this space of being an entrepreneur because of, you know, family or whatever excuses you want to make to keep you there. But I did the same thing. I think if you can look at your situation right now, what is the worst case scenario? You said that, right? Yeah. When you can balance that with how happy you'll be, it becomes kind of a no-brainer to 100%. See what you want to do, you know? So that's very, very powerful. You mentioned something earlier about, you know, the job interview and the type of your style and who you were and I remember young Brock with the ponytail. You know what I'm saying?
People don't know about that.
The long hair.
That's crazy.
Oh, we're going to bring up some pictures. Don't worry about that. I got some, you know? Yeah. And then going into a space, trying to be yourself and maybe adapting or not adapting to that. Can you speak on that a little bit?
Yeah, that's an incredible question too, man. I feel like times have changed a lot. Mm-hmm. So people listening today, I think, might have a little more freedom than we did back then. But at the same time, when I went into my Flow internship, now this is going to sound funny because it's the mecca of hip hop, right? I thought I could go as an intern and do my job as who I am. I had never been in a professional space before to know any different than like, well, it's hip hop. I'm going as me. So I still remember I went that day with white, blue, and red Reebok pumps from Lounge. I had the Lounge jersey.
Shout out to Lounge. To match, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Had the Lounge jersey to Matt, and I had like a Expos fitted backwards with the ponytail. And
was it like 3X or what?
Oh, yeah, everything. Yeah, yeah. This is so weird. Everything was huge. So I walk in, and I think this is normal. Like, I think this is where I'm supposed to be. And then you get in the office and like people are wearing suits and like button ups or like fitted jeans. And I was just like, oh, like I misread the room, whatever. And I still remember, like, I don't know if it was Aisha or Toa, rest in peace, Toa, man. Someone pulled me aside and was like, yo, this is hip hop, but like you have to be professional. So don't dress like that next time you come. I was like, oh shit, I messed up.
Mm.
But you know, it was cool. It was a learning curve.
Yeah.
And it's not like I had to switch up to like khakis and a plaid shirt. Like everyone was still cool and you could be you. I just couldn't be
that you.
That, you know, like
yeah.
that version. So mm-hmm. that was one learning. But then when I flipped to the more corporate design job in the studio, I still remember I went into my job interview mm-hmm. and I had learned what I had learned, but at the same time I always felt like people should judge you on like your character and in this case the work you're providing, you're showing, not how I look, right? So it was tough to not bend the rules. Mm-hmm. So I went into this interview and I remember a blue Jays fitted. It was a brown Jays fitted. Mm-hmm. I did up the ante a little bit and I wore like a blue, a brown Lacoste collared shirt.
Okay.
Like,
all right. You
know, so yeah. I put the collar on.
Yeah, collar.
but I also decided to keep my grills in.
Oh,
my bottom fronts, diamond cuts, two diamonds in the fangs.
Jeez.
Did that interview. And the interviews with like two like middle-aged white dudes from a totally different space and era.
I bet.
Very nice, like amazing, very respectful. But they did the interview and I showed my work and they were blown away. And, you know, I got a call the next day or whatever. Yo, you're hired. Amazing. Fast forward, we get to the Christmas party and everyone's drinking, having a good time. They pull me aside and I feel like I got a lot of stories where people just pull me aside. they pulled me aside and they're like, we don't understand it. We don't really get it. But it took a lot of balls to come to that interview with gold teeth. And, you know, we respect you for it. And that was like a really big moment for me. And I understand that not everyone will ever be in a position for someone to say that to them.
Right.
I also know that there's a level of privilege that comes with my skin tone, even if I don't necessarily fit in with a certain group.
Mm-hmm.
It may not happen for everyone, but in that moment, I finally felt one glimmer of hope of saying you can be yourself if your work is good enough. And I've just never let that go since, if that makes sense.
That makes more than a lot of sense. That's very, very powerful, man. And I think our whole community can learn from that. And I know you said it was it's in the past and things have kind of changed and the world is opening up a little bit, but it is important to be yourself.
100%.
Right? It may be cliche a little bit, but, and me and Alicia were talking about this earlier, how a lot of artists feel like they have to lose some of that individuality to get to where they need to go.
Right.
And that might help in the short term, but you don't want to be an older person and even with fame and success and not, and having it be not for being your true self.
Totally.
You know?
That's an amazing point, because at the end of the day, you have to live with your own decisions. And I know confidently at this stage of the game, like I'm in my mid 40s now, I can confidently say and look back, I didn't compromise for anyone. I'm still the same person, maybe just with less hair, but I'm still the same person. I still have the core values, right, and I'm still fighting the same causes that I've always fought for. Yeah. So no one can say shit to me. And that doesn't come from an ego space. It comes from being comfortable and knowing that I'm going to move through life how I want to.
Yeah.
And I'm not doing anything that's going to harm anyone.
Right.
This doesn't affect anyone. And if anything, I hope it provides some version of hope or inspiration. There's nothing else but that's attached to it.
So good, man. Everybody and their mama right now is selling merch. Shout out to DDHD merch. You know
that's
what I
wicked.
Mean? make sure you cop some of that. But you very early had some success with merchandising and selling products with One Love T.O.
Right.
Right? Ooh. I'm bringing it all the way back there, man.
I love
like,
it. I
yeah,
love it.
And if you weren't outside at those times, I mean, the One Love T.O. movement was so monumental in my eyes. It was, the whole city was wearing it. Can you talk about like how that kind of happened and the virality of it?
Man, so this was like pre-social media to the way we know it today.
Right.
This was like MySpace and Facebook days.
Mm-hmm.
So it was more about hitting the pavement and doing things in person than ever reaching a large audience online. And I honestly think that's probably one of the key things that allowed us to do what we did was it was in person. Like, you had to know Rex, or you had to know Lo, or you had to know me to get a t-shirt. You couldn't just go to a store or go online, or like there was no easy way to figure it out. It was like when you used to search for music, like you had to go and dig. So I think there was something special about that experience.
People maybe wanted it more because it wasn't as easily accessible.
100%. That worked in our favor, not knowing it at the time, but for sure looking back. And then I also think we were just in a unique time in Toronto.
Yeah.
Our generation was like the first generation that was making noise in a way of like, maybe this is possible.
Yes.
You know, we didn't have a ton of people in the generation before us that made, quote unquote, made it. They found success and they saw a lot of things that weren't seen before them either. But I mean, our generation was the first to start to make a noise. And I think One Love T.O. just came at a perfect cross section of like, the city was turning into something where community was allowed and civic pride was starting to take shape.
Yes.
And this was something where if you're from Toronto back in the day, you know, it was a New York fitted, you didn't tell what neighborhood you were from, and Carabana, you were definitely talking about being from a different city.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So like, things were shifting, yeah. And we just, I think timing is everything, and we just hit it at the right time.
Yeah.
And the idea of bringing people together and actually celebrating our differences, that was one of the big things with One Love T.O. It was the fact that the city of Toronto is so multicultural,
mm-hmm.
but if all you were to do is stay in your bubble and only know that bubble, you're missing out on what Toronto has to offer.
Mm-hmm.
So One Love T.O. transitioned from like a few t-shirts during Carabana to the blog and the website, yes. era, where we also got lucky with timing, because that was when like Two Dope Boys and OVO, like the original October's Very Own,
yes.
Photo Wills, Lost in the Wilderness, like yes. all these blogs were popping up, and we chose to use our online platform as a way of highlighting Toronto talent and highlighting issues in Toronto. And I think all of that was just so unique because it had never been done prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's what opened the doors for us to see maybe the impact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you start having like kids come up to you on the street being like, yo, like I love One Love T.O. or can I get an autograph or can we take a picture? Like, that stuff's crazy. And that would happen more for Tyrone because he's more of the face and the personality. But even still, like, just seeing that is incredible. So you know you're making an impact.
Mm-hmm.
And then things just went viral in their own way. People started bringing it around the world. So they go on vacation or go on a trip or go visit family back home. They'd wear the shirt. They'd bring shirts to someone. And before you knew it, people started posting shirts like, I'm in Ghana, I'm in Jamaica, I'm in Greece, I'm in Paris. You're like, yo, our shirt's around the world.
Oh, yeah.
And then we started showcasing online, like One Love T.O. around the world,
yes.
posting these photos. And eventually that's when the doors opened for us as a brand.
Yeah.
Because we didn't start it as a business. We did this as something like together for fun, as a community thing. It was not to make money. And it grew into a business. And then that's when brands like Roots was knocking on the door. Toronto Blue Jay. And yo, before I get into anything else, Roots was like a dream come true for
Hell
us.
Hell yeah.
That was on our list. Like, I still wish I had the piece of paper. But that was the list of brands that we thought made sense for One Love T.O. to collab with. And this is kind of when collabs were just starting with brands and other artists or groups. So collabing with Roots Canada on like a Canada Day t-shirt, like that was insane for us.
Insane,
right?
Yeah.
And to see like a lineup down the street at a Roots store for us, and not necessarily us personally, but I mean like our message.
Yes.
That was like, I can't even really bring words to that feeling. And it just happened over and over again. We did more Roots collabs. We did Toronto Raptors. We did Toronto Blue Jays. We started to become like a iconic symbol of Toronto.
Yeah.
And the coolest thing was it was a positive message that brought people together. Like, that stuff's really easy to be corny. It's also really easy to have people not subscribe to that because of their old ways.
Yeah.
So we all felt like really fortunate to be able to bring something like that to our city and let the city embrace it and almost turn it into something bigger than what we could have ever imagined.
Yo, that's crazy, man. Did you have any I mean, it did so well, but I'm sure, were there times where there were setbacks or like on the man was too high, or did you have to pivot at all throughout that time?
Cool. I think looking back, well, when you're in it, you're just in grind mode.
Yeah.
And you're trying to keep up with what you think the world needs.
Yes.
And what you want to provide. But looking back, it would have been so dope if we had like a little more business acumen to ourselves at that age and approach like an investor.
Yeah.
Or maybe had like a company like Roots or someone buy in.
Right.
Because we had no infrastructure, we had no staff, we had no money. So I think like as beautiful as One Love TO was, it did its thing. It was there for the time that it was meant to be there.
Right.
But looking back, if you had infrastructure and money invested, it probably could have become a way bigger brand, probably a way bigger company. Mm-hmm. And who knows, it still might have been like very active to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say it's a regret or that I wish that had happened, but it's cool to know that if we had had access to money or infrastructure, maybe it could have got even bigger.
I know. Hindsight's 2020. We all know.
Totally.
There's a lot of that going on. Is there a reason why it slowed down or stopped? Is it?
Yeah, I think there's like a bunch, like there's layers to that.
Yeah.
One, you can only do one thing so well for so long.
That part.
And the t-shirts, although we had like switched up some things over the time, we'd done some different things like new era fitteds and cut and sew, like custom crew necks and hoodies.
Yeah.
We were switching things up, but at the end of the day, that can only go so far.
Mm-hmm.
And without the infrastructure or money and time or resources like space, mm-hmm. an office, you can't necessarily work on what should come next. You're just kind of like juggling what's happening now. So I think that was one thing. Another thing would be just like the time period.
Mm.
We were on the upswing of Toronto's reputation build.
Right.
We got it to a point, and along with a million other folks pushing that same message, we got it to a point as a city where we didn't need to be there the same way we used to be. Toronto had reached that level that we thought was never obtainable. We hoped it was, but we were just out there doing, you know, seeing if it could happen. It happened. You know, it happened with Drake.
It happened, bro.
It happened with The Weeknd. It happened with Kari. It happened on so many different levels. Actors, producers, like it happened.
Yeah.
So when that started happening, the beautiful thing was all these other brands started popping up being like, yo, I love Toronto, or, you know, the message of Toronto's community or Toronto over everything, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, that means we did our job.
Yeah.
And at that level of, or not level, sorry, at that age where we're all no longer kids and we're starting to branch off into like figuring out what our own careers mm-hmm. and what life looks like, you couldn't have enough time in your day to make One Love To You any bigger than it got. So between the message, the time, and our own energy, like availability time, there was nothing more that it could be.
Right.
So I think we did exactly what the city needed, mm-hmm. and I'm very happy to see all the people that have like carried the torch forward.
Do you think anything like that could happen again in this space, in this day?
I think it can.
Yeah.
I think, in all honesty, people come up to us all the time asking about, yo, is you going to bring One Love TO back, or like, you still have t-shirts or whatever. Now, it doesn't need to be us that makes this happen again.
Yeah.
But Toronto's at a breaking point again.
Yeah.
I think we've gone through this huge trajectory where we were no one, then we were someone, and now we're fragmented again. And the sense of community isn't quite the same as it was during the One Love TO days. And I think people are actually looking for that. So I think there's a huge void in Toronto right now for someone to step in and say, let me figure this out. Let me bring everyone together. Let me create something for everyone.
You are a mentor at the Remix Project
for
a long time. And Remix is, I mean, I can't say enough good things about that and how it's birthed so many great artists and entrepreneurs in that space. And not just the music, but in front, behind the camera, all parts of entertainment.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about like your experience with them and why is it the Remix just what it is?
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll bring it back to the first time I got introduced to Remix.
Okay.
Which was probably like its second or third year, like 2006, 2007.
Right.
And I volunteered as a mentor just because I had done a lot of stuff in the design world. I was like, yeah, I'm cool. Like, maybe I could like help a young person. That experience for me was...
Was that through Lowe?
That was actually through Tyrone and Gavin and Drex.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. They invited me to be a mentor. Mm-hmm. And then that experience for me was like life-changing. Yeah. I actually think that like put my life in a direction that I didn't know it could go.
Right.
But the experience of helping a young person, guiding, sharing knowledge, but being equals versus like how a lot of us went to high school or maybe post-secondary, we were talked to, not with. We were taught to, not with. And I think this was the first time I was able to sit down and teach and talk with someone. So that experience changed my mind on what's possible. Yeah. And Brian Espiritu at the time was actually running the creative arts program.
Yeah.
Eventually, he decided to leave and do his own work and do some agency stuff. And that's when they hit me up to be full time. And so I was able to like still do all my design and everything and then take on this role. The trajectory of Remix over the last like 15 years has been insane.
Insane.
Like the success stories are out of this world. Grammy nominated, Grammy award winning, Juno award winning. But then, like you said, behind the camera, we've got people working at like Universal Music, Sony Music, Warner Music as A&R and marketing directors, and you know, you name it. And we've got people in the business world or people that have worked for MLSE, Toronto Raptors coaching staff. Like, these success stories are insane.
And also Alicia, who's our producer of the show.
There you go, right?
Who's also Remix alumni as well. Alumni, yeah, 100%. Sure. Yeah.
So I think for me, it's and I said this actually in a post not that long ago, like on Instagram or something, but I came to the realization that I think what my life is about is less about my individual success and understanding that I have the ability to have an impact and inspire others. Mm. And when I see other people that have been inspired, there's like that ripple effect. And I start to, at this age anyways, I'm starting to realize my success is actually seeing someone else succeed.
That part.
And that's what Remix for me is about.
Yes.
There's just no other way that you can make an impact on the industry and a young person's life unless you put in the time, energy, and effort and are willing to grow together.
Yeah. Isn't it so funny how, like, because I've been making music a long time, and you know, sometimes you do have to be selfish in that space to get where you need to go. But I've experienced some of my biggest successes by being unselfish and trying to help others when it didn't necessarily benefit me.
Yeah.
A couple years ago, we did the Broken Toy Initiative, right? And I was able to raise thousands of dollars for special needs children and their family. And I do have a daughter who has special needs, and I just wanted to give back to anybody who was in that space because I knew how hard it could be. And I've toured all over the place. I've had, you know, success with music. I've met amazing celebrities and stuff like that, but I've never had a better feeling than handing off that check, you know, and that's knowing amazing. That we did something for somebody else. So yeah. I think everybody could take something from that, because especially in the music business, it's almost celebrated to be more selfish sometimes and look out for yourself this and that, because you know, there's always people who are gonna fuck you over and treat you like you're less deserving of. And once that happens once or twice, you feel like, yo, I'm not even trying to help out nobody no more. I'm gonna do my thing.
Yeah.
But that's a double-edged sword. So I think you just proved it right there, that just, you know, being a mentor and helping out other people in that space only benefits you at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's full circle, it's reciprocal. Like, I can't see a better scenario if you wanna like help someone that ends up helping you regardless.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I did a song. I'm getting into me right now. I know it's your interview.
Let's do it.
I did a song called Broken Toy, dedicated to my daughter. And that's beautiful. Thank you. And in that song, I actually talk about a time that I met with Drake, or Drake introduced himself to me, saying that he wanted to work on his mixtape, which was Comeback Season at the time, and how he heard my freestyle on Flow when Scratch was killing all the freestyles and stuff. And he was just like, yo, you sound like Jay-Z, bro. Yo, we got to get into the studio, this, this, and that. But I say that to say that happened at one of your parties.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was at the end of a shuffle party.
That's sick. That's
right, where we met up. It didn't happen because I was being selfish and I was just working on my own stuff at the time. But you have been not part of, I mean, not one, two, maybe even more events in the city that have been like pivotal. Like I just yeah, think about these parties and some of the best times of my life have been there.
Same.
So yeah, right?
Yeah.
So like, how did the nostalgia and the shuffle parties and all these events you've been doing, how did you talk to me about that?
Yeah, man? Yeah, that's really cool. Man, it's like anything. I rarely started anything as a business. It's mainly all started from like a point of passion.
Mm-hmm.
And music, bringing people together for a good time, has always been a thing since I was in high school doing the DJing and promoting parties.
Yes.
So when I made it to Toronto and I ended up meeting Lo and Tyrone, it eventually just became like very natural that we would do something like that.
Yes.
And at the time, I think Nostalgia was first, but someone else started that party. Mm-hmm. And I was actually doing the graphic design work for the flyers. And then I went to the first party and I was like, yo, I think we could make this party better. Like, you've got an amazing foundation. Like, let's see what we could do. And before you knew it, me, Lo, and Rex joined that group and turned Nostalgia into something a lot bigger.
Yes.
And hopefully better for the people. And to this day, like that, what are we in 2023, 2024 almost? Mm-hmm. That party's like 18 years old. And we just did one like 2 or 3 weeks ago, where we had Fat Joe come out and Drake, you know, came through and pretty much did a co-host with Rex and did like a sound clash for this.
I'm so mad I wasn't there, bro. I'm so mad. It looked like the spot. Yeah,
it was literally like one of those Toronto nights from back in the day, like when we were all on the come up. It felt exactly like that.
It looked like that.
It was so good. But yeah, man, we've been doing that for like 18 years. Shortly into the Nostalgia run, we were like, yo, there's no parties that do like multi-genre.
Mm-hmm.
Like when we used to go to the club, you would hear like the hip hop set, the reggae set, the R&B set, and maybe soca, but usually not unless it was a special party. So you hear those like 3 or 4 genres and that was it. We're like, we know everyone listens to more music than just those genres. We know that's the popular one. That's the one that we're all into. But as kids, we all knew what Nirvana was, right? We all knew who Pearl Jam was. We all knew who, I don't even know, anything from like a different genre back in the day.
Right.
It was popular music. So we're like, how come there's no party like that? And I remember when I used to DJ in high school, before we had decks and like turntables and records or whatever, we would pre-burn CDs and we would go. And if the house party only had a CD player, it'd usually be like that 5-disc changer.
Yeah.
We literally put it in and hit his shuffle.
Shuffle, yeah.
And that was where like the idea came from. So we're like, let's throw a party that plays all types of music.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about that was, this was when the term mashup hadn't fully developed. So we were throwing a party where we would play all these different records in a night. But then within like the first year of us throwing that party, the term mashup became super popular, which was essentially remixing records that don't sound like they should go together, putting them together. And that was like a groundbreaking time for us, because we broke down doors just by throwing a party where like people could come in and lose their mind. And Rex used to have this amazing saying where it was like, leave your cool at the door.
Yes.
This isn't about posing up, buying a bottle, or doing anything to look cool. This was literally about the version of yourself at home that dances in the mirror for fun when no one's watching. Or the person.
Correct me if
singing.
I'm wrong, but did you have a VIP section? Were there bottle like sections?
Not initially.
Right.
Bottle service didn't even come into Toronto until years after.
True.
And even then, our version of bottle service was a Heineken. Like, that was us. You know? Like, I feel like we invented the six-pack as being a desirable thing to have at the club.
Facts, man.
Which actually brought Heineken on board and they were our sponsor because of that.
I remember, like, it would be like maybe that? Closer to like the bar closing, and then T-Rex would have like a case of Heineken and he'd just be like giving them out to people to keep the party going on stage, man. Yeah, I thought that was beautiful. Yeah.
So there's all these like little moments within the parties that we did that we were just doing because it's fun.
Yeah.
But we didn't know, once again, that they would have impact.
Right.
And people have gotten married because they met at our parties. People have probably got divorced because they met at our parties.
They went to the party after and they got divorced.
Yeah. Should have stayed home. people got jobs from that party.
Yeah.
You know, and there's just like memories for years. Like we did Shuffle for 10 years straight.
Amazing.
Every month. That's 120 months in a row. Never taken a night off.
Mm.
And, you know, we could say we did it, but essentially it's the crowd that kept coming. So they empowered that night.
Yeah.
They kept it going.
Yeah. And I mean, you see that impact in today, like with mashup parties or all types of parties who are following that same blueprint now.
I feel like what the Boiler Room is so good at doing
mm-hmm.
is essentially like we were doing a much rawer, like pared down version of that without knowing it.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Team Canada, like Grand Theft, like the DJ.
Yeah.
Like those guys were way ahead of their time.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure, man. Let's talk about graphic design, man, and all the amazing things you've done in that space as well. People might not realize, obviously, you did Cardi and working with that for Not For Sale and Dangerous. But you are also responsible for, I want to say, the branding of a prominent Toronto R&B group, Division.
I definitely had a hand in it.
A hand in it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like you did maybe the first three covers, I believe.
Yeah, and I didn't shoot all three.
Yeah.
But creative direct and worked on concept with the team.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about that squad is like everyone's very creative.
Yes.
Like Daniel Daly's got his own ideas. 1985 has his own ideas. And then you've got management, label, OVO, super successful. Like everyone's got incredible ideas to bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes down to brainstorming, there was never like a shortage of ideas in which way it could go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, it's always been cool to see a vision and help bring it to life.
Yeah.
I don't always have to be the one doing everything. I could just do one role, but if it's helping everyone else get there,
yeah,
that's cool too. So the first album, I did creative direction and graphic design.
Okay.
But Bronze also helped with design on that.
Oh, big him up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Yassine actually did the photo shoot.
Okay.
So we were we were a crew that shot that for the first album, which was like pretty much just the Division symbol.
Yes.
Glowing that neon sign.
What store was that in?
We actually talked to my homie Phil over at Libertine.
Ah.
Yeah. So if anyone doesn't know, the cover was shot there.
Nice.
We took the tarot card reading side out and we had pre-measured and made our own Division sign to go in. And we shot that before one night that they were opening.
Right.
So that was really cool. The second album, which was crazy, I went morning after.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Cuba, me and LaShawn Harris, really dope filmmaker and photographer.
Mm-hmm.
We went on a trip to Cuba to basically guerrilla everything. Like we had no idea if our ideas were feasible, but they were like, yo, get on a flight. You got a week in Cuba. Let's see what you can do. We had our ideas, we had our vision board, we had everything.
Mm-hmm.
But, yo, we kind of fucked up because me and LaShawn don't speak Spanish, okay?
Yeah.
We didn't bring enough money. we also didn't really have, like, a tour guide or anyone to, like, show us around. So we were kind of just, like, on our own. But the really cool thing about that is when you're put in positions where the pressure's on and people are counting on you, at least from my mindset, you always try and figure out a way to make it happen.
Yeah.
So we made it happen. But here's another like Easter egg for people.
Mm.
That morning after album cover,
mm-hmm.
I was never supposed to shoot that album cover as a photographer. I was just supposed to be the creative director and eventually design the album artwork. LaShawn was there to shoot all the video and photo. But our talent fell through, partially because we couldn't speak Spanish, partially because communication and things weren't working out timing wise. So the front cover of the Division album, the morning after, that's actually LaShawn on the cover.
It's not Daniel?
No.
What?
It was just me and LaShawn in Cuba. It was crazy, man. Not a lot of people know that.
No, I didn't know that. Yeah.
But that's like if we had those like Much Music pop-up videos, that would be it.
Yeah.
So he was supposed to be the shooter. Mm-hmm. I was just supposed to make sure we found the locations and made it look the way that the vision board was.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a crazy experience, man.
And you guys went on tour together as well?
Yeah, we did tour. We did the morning after tour.
And
that was really cool because I got to not only travel with my friends, mm-hmm. But we got to see the world in a way that most people never get to see.
Right.
Right. And for me as a creative, one of the dreams was always to travel with my work. I never knew how that was going to come true, but being on tour actually made the most sense. I just never knew as a kid you could like go on tour. That was not a thing for me. So going on tour, I was able to not only design the tour merch, I got to run that portion of like the business while we're on the road.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to see like what people gravitated towards, what people were buying, what people liked and didn't like. And I got to hear people talk. And it's crazy because I'm the artist for the artist. No one knows that I designed the shit or that I had a hand in it. So I'm just like this like fly on the wall.
Yeah.
And it's such a cool experience. Even when you hear negative stuff, it's okay because you learn from it. But like it's more or less all positive.
Yeah.
So you're just like, whoa, like this is a crazy feeling again. And then from tour, we came back and then the third album came, Amusing My Feelings. And Othello Gray actually shot that cover. Okay. Yeah.
Who shot it? Sorry?
Othello Gray.
Okay.
Really dope photographer.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just did the creative direction and another Easter egg. If you see like the drawings in mm-hmm. the album artwork, it was me and another girl, Chloe, that actually did the sketches.
Really?
Of the Muse.
Yeah, the Muse. Yeah. That's dope, man. That's dope. Are you guys still good now? Are you going on tour with them now?
Man.
Are you doing tattoos for the girls as well?
No, I'll leave that to Daniel. Tour life is amazing, but I would probably never do it again.
Oh, man. I'm not even going to get into what you've seen on tour with those guys because I'm sure it's crazy.
I'm good.
Yeah, but shout out to Daniel, man. That's the homie right there. All right, so what's next, man, for Brian Brock? Yo, I see you in this space of street photography, man, and I've never seen you happier than I've seen you right now. So,
I love that.
Yeah, so talk to me a little bit about this new endeavor you're on.
Yeah, okay, so I think for me, the pandemic was like my reset. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people were able to take some time and look at themselves. And at that point, I realized I was doing way too much. I enjoyed all the things I was doing, but at the same time, I didn't necessarily need to do them all. I was just filling my time up with things to do instead of probably taking care of myself. And at that point, I realized something needed to change. And I also realized that I had stopped like creating for myself.
Yes.
All these things I was doing, whether it was owning a business or working with artists or doing freelance work, I was being creative, but I was creating for someone else's end goal, for their benefit. And I was like, yo, I didn't get into being an artist to do stuff for other people. Yes, that's how you could pay the bills. But I mean, when I was in high school, I would create for fun. There was no deadlines. There was no budgets. There was no clients. I was just happy creating.
Right.
And I realized over the pandemic that a part of me, I had lost a part of me. And it was a very happy part of me. And it was the part that could create. So in the summer of 2019, I picked up a camera and I just started wandering the streets like a very lost person, you know?
Like a lot of us were during that time.
Yeah, like it didn't make sense and I didn't know what I was doing. But at the end of the day, there was this feeling when you get on the street and you're slowing yourself down.
Mm.
I used to be the guy that would be like rushing to get from point A to point B.
Mm.
And I wouldn't pay attention to anything in between. But when you slow down, you realize the life that is happening between point A and point B is incredible. There's so many moments and special things that I probably missed because I was in a hurry.
Yeah.
So, and this just might be me getting older as well, but slowing down, there's a lot of value in that. So hitting the street, I'm on the street, I'm shooting, I'm looking for things, I'm trying to become more aware of my surroundings. And then eventually I get to a point where I'm like, yo, this is not only like therapy, but I think it's humbling in a way that I've never experienced before. So I was able to take myself off of maybe my own pedestal, or if anyone had built me up on one, the street kind of like levels the playing field. Everyone is just a person. No one knows who you are. No one knows what you've done. No one knows what you've been through. Mm-hmm. But you're sharing space in a big city like Toronto for a very brief moment. And if I can capture a moment that's never going to happen again, and I get a feeling from that, or someone else eventually sees that image and gets a feeling, yeah, then I know I'm doing something right. And I'm really cool with where I'm at right now doing street photography. I've been very fortunate that people have been drawn to my work. I've got to do shows in Seattle, two shows in New York, a solo show in Toronto, and a group show in Toronto. And I released my first photo book over a year ago with a New York-based photographer.
That's
we collaborated.
Dope. Yeah.
Shout out Sam Floyd. He's really dope.
That's super dope, man.
And so I'm really just on this like artist journey.
Yes.
Which isn't too far off from like where you started your journey as a musician. Mm-hmm. It took me a whole like almost career to get to the point where I'm like, I need to be an artist again. Yes. Because I hadn't felt that since I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And I think like Virgil had a quote about something like he does everything for the 17-year-old version of himself. Mm. That's literally where I'm at.
Yeah, me too, man. Me too. Yeah. I can totally relate to that. And it's so funny how it takes us so long to get to that point where we wanted to be in the beginning.
Yeah.
But you have to go through life, bro. You gotta understand these things. And I think knowing what you don't want comes from the experience.
You're right.
And then that brings you back to what you do want as a kid.
Yeah, know? My clarity for that is way better.
Yeah.
And even now working with clients for photography, I'm getting booked. But it's so interesting because I didn't pick up a camera to make money.
Right.
I did it to be an artist and to like fulfill something that I was missing. The cool thing is now I don't have to say yes to a job. If someone wants to work with me, and we talked about this earlier, but if someone wants to work with me, it's only if I want to work with you. And if the work we're going to create together is something that I'm going to be happy about, I'm not interested in getting a paycheck for doing work that's not for me.
Yeah.
Someone else could do that job and they're going to kill it. It's just not for me.
Right.
So it's a cool space to be in, even as a creative and as an entrepreneur, to kind of be able to say no when you want to.
I think that is what equals success, if you ask me. You know, a lot of people connect it to monetary gain, mm-hmm. but to me, success is being able to say no to things, you know, and not be having to forced into situations for money or, you know, just to pay your rent or stuff like that, but to really do things because you're attached to it from your heart.
100%. I couldn't agree more.
All right. So home stretch, man.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on. First of all, yo, this has been beautiful. I think our community is going to learn a lot from everything. But there is a lot of people out there who are at the crossroads, right? They might be transitioning from a full-time job into wherever they're going to go. They're not sure how to do it. They've had a lot of pitfalls. They might feel like giving up and calling it quits. So in your opinion, we just like you to look into the camera and tell them why you think dreams don't have deadlines.
Yeah, that's an amazing, amazing quote. Dreams definitely don't have deadlines. I think for myself, a word of advice to anyone would be, you could start somewhere, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to end where you thought you were going to end. And that's okay. But if you continue to put in the work and you stay focused and you're not willing to let anyone else persuade you off the path that you feel is right for you, inevitably that path will happen. Your journey will come true. But if you listen to the naysayers, or if you don't get up after you fall down, and it's cliche to say, but it really is like up to you to do the work. And if you don't do it, it's not going to happen. I always relate it back to actors. Some of the actors that we know, some of our favorite actors, we don't know them until they're in their 50s or 60s or sometimes 70s. Mm. What did they do for those 40, 50 years of their life before becoming famous and getting recognized for their craft, right? It could take so long for some of us to get to where we need to be. And it's okay. If you don't want to put in the work, then it's not for you. But I challenge everyone to put in the work, because that journey is more rewarding than anything else in life.
Well said, my friend. Well said, my friend. Great job. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show,
thank you,
bro.
Man. Like, this is crazy for me to be able to sit across from you. Like, we met probably on like a music video set some like rap concert.
Yep.
So to fast forward this many years and be able to see what you're doing, like, it's a blessing. I'm very thankful. Like, this is special for me.
I appreciate that so much, man. And I think I speak on everybody at the DDH podcast where, yo, you have an open invitation. We support everything that you're doing, and you're welcome back anytime, man.
Yo, because I appreciate that.
You fully represent what it means that dreams don't have deadlines. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right, yo. Then that's it for today, man. My name is Juice Rochester, Rochester Juice. And remember, a dream is what you make it, but you'll never make it without a dream. It's my man, Brian Brock. Let's go, y'all.